And we are trying to live stream tonight. We'll see if that gets going. If not, we are definitely recording it for audio, and it will be on Radio Tacoma. So we again appreciate you being here. We did make a list of upcoming events, and we'll highlight some of those after the session. And we're just really, really thrilled to have Dan Villa and Bradley Thompson here from 350 Tacoma. They have been working quite a long time on the LNG plant situation, and they will update us on that. And then we'll talk to you some more about what kinds of things we can do afterwards. So Dan and Bradley.
Greetings. Why don't you come over here? We'll introduce ourselves. So my name is Bradley Thompson. I'm with 350 Tacoma. In the advertising, it said I was with 350 Seattle, which I'll take. Not a bad deal. But I'm here representing actually 350 Tacoma, not 350 Seattle.
And I'm Dan Villa, and I'm with 350 Tacoma as well. And yeah, thank you very much for having us here tonight.
So one thing we try to do at 350 Tacoma is we start every meeting really with a native land acknowledgement, so we'd like to start with that. And what we acknowledge is we acknowledge whose land we do this work on, and tonight actually in this place, we are standing on stolen Puyallup tribal land. And so we acknowledge that, and we think about the impact that that has on the work that we do, and really on the presentation that we're about to give. So maybe just take a brief second, and we're going to think about what that means to be on Puyallup land. Thank you. So we're going to give kind of a PowerPoint presentation. This PowerPoint was developed with many, many minds, so we didn't necessarily develop this ourselves, but there's many, many groups who are in coalition helping to work on this project or defeat this project, actually. And so I want to give acknowledgement to them, and later on we'll talk about some of the other groups that have been very active in this fight. We'll go through the PowerPoint, so some things, we'll go a little quickly through some of it, mostly to get to the place where we have questions and answers, because I feel like in many ways that's the most important part of this presentation. So what is Tacoma LNG? I'm going to assume people have some knowledge of LNG. It's hard to escape, really, Puget Sound Energy's advertising, which has been everywhere for about 2.5 years. They've done push polling, so they've called people at their homes. You've seen advertising online, on TV, at the movie theater. You've seen advertising everywhere. So I'm going to start just by introducing kind of its location. And so it's located in the Port of Tacoma, or we might call that the Tacoma Tide Flats. This waterway in front of me is the Hylabos Waterway, so closest to northeast Tacoma. And then the waterway on the other side there is the Blair Waterway. So we're really talking about more on the east side of the actual tide flats. You'll see there's Tacoma in the background. That's downtown Tacoma. And then you'll see that's a tote ship, or tote maritime shipping. It's a container shipping yard. Tote is a company I'll talk a little bit about in a minute. But tote really does a round trip trip to Anchorage, Alaska, where they supply a lot of goods and supplies to Alaska. This project is, kind of in brief, it's a $310 million project. It's being built by Puget Sound Energy. This project has been in place since 2014. Actually, they put out proposals back in probably 2012. Puget Sound Energy was one of the companies that responded to the proposal, and they're the ones who are continuing to build the project. This project is under construction, as you can see, but they say it's a little less than half built. And so really what you recognize here is a storage tank. It's an 8 million gallon storage tank. And so connected to this, that's only one part of the project, will be really processing of gas. So gas has to be processed before it's super cooled. In other words, liquefied, so a gas turns into a liquid, and then it's stored in the tank, and we'll talk about what it's stored or what it's used for. So why build it? Why are they building it? So I'll say this, which is it's a complex project. That's part of why it's been so difficult to kind of explain the project is it's one of the more complex projects or multifaceted projects with liquefied natural gas that we've seen in the United States. So it involves fuel for tote vessels. So tote has two vessels that go, like I say, round trip from Tacoma to Anchorage. And so what it would be replacing would be dirty bunker fuel. And so they're currently burning what's called bunker fuel, which is very dirty. The emissions are dirty. There's lots of particulate matter that would come from that. And so to burn just at that point of ignition, the tote ships would actually be cleaner if they burnt natural gas. But we'll talk about why that's actually not the whole story. And it is only a very small part of the story. You'll see that the ships, like I say, they're currently only, they have contracts with Tote. They don't have contracts with other ships in the port, but that's a big sales pitch from the Port of Tacoma is that they'll say that other ships potentially could use or switch to natural gas, but we'll talk about why that's probably not going to happen. The second part of the project is called peak shaving. So what is peak shaving? Peak shaving essentially is kind of buying gas when it's cheapest, which is in the summer, when demand is low, and they fill the tank really with stored liquid natural gas, and they save it up to the winter, and they say it'll be needed on the coldest days in the winter. Well, as climate change makes our climate warmer, those days become fewer and fewer. And so they say a few days, probably every 2 years, there would be demand, enough demand to where they may have to tap kind of reserves in this tank. What it's used for is actually this peak shaving plant, which is in Frederickson. It's a natural gas energy plant. And so what happens there is when demand is very high for gas, because we're all, people are burning gas in their homes, they actually will switch to diesel. And so the natural gas would actually replace the demand for diesel on these few coldest days every 2 years. The other thing I'll say about maritime bunkering or this marine fuel is that this would only be the third maritime or LNG maritime bunkering facility in all of North America. And so there's only two others. There's one in Jacksonville, Florida, and there's one in Louisiana. By far, this is the most complicated. The others are very tiny in comparison. And also, this is close to an urban center or dense populations, which everyone says is not best practices. So other uses would be they may sell it. Obviously, they would want to sell it and make as much money off of cheap gas as they can. So it may be transported by truck. It could be transported by ship or barge, and so it could be actually transported up to Seattle, let's say other vessels up there. Let's say there was demand for LNG up there. It potentially could go up by barge and fuel other vessels that way. The other thing they've talked about in the original proposal was actually moving LNG by rail. And so on our rails, just along with other oil, would be natural gas or liquefied natural gas. Again, that's been very controversial because it hasn't been approved really by the federal government. And so there would be a lot of permitting involved before that would be allowed. And then last would just be truck transportation. So they may transport this up and down the I-5 corridor. So in tanker trucks like this, they would be selling it all up and down the I-5 corridor.
All right, so why are we concerned about methane? and natural gas. So methane is the primary component of natural gas. So whenever you hear that, you need to remember that it is methane. And methane is a very important greenhouse gas to track, because we all know about carbon dioxide, right? About the Paris Climate Accords, trying to limit the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But we also want to limit the methane, because methane, it turns out, is actually much worse for climate change than is carbon dioxide. So yeah, just for now, keep in mind that natural gas does equal methane. And so where do we get all this natural gas or methane? A lot of it these days comes from fracking. And does anybody know what fracking is? Anybody want to volunteer what that is?
It's called hydraulic fracturing, and it's made by blasting out water to force the natural gas out. And that often causes earthquakes, but they say it doesn't cause earthquakes.
Yeah, that's correct. So hydraulic fracturing is the long name for it. Fracking is the nickname. And what they do is they drill down into the earth, into the shale, and they inject water and sand and a mix of proprietary chemicals that they say is a trade secret, but is full of toxins for the environment and for us. And then what that does is it breaks open the shale and releases the natural gas, and then that's when they collect it. And so about 75% of all natural gas in North America now comes from fracking. And this is already, okay. So, now, this is a liquefied natural gas plant. So how do we take natural gas and turn it into liquefied natural gas? And that's through a process of cryogenically freezing it. So what they do is they first remove all the impurities, like other types of natural gases, and then they bring it down to minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit, at which point that gas then becomes a liquid, and that's where they store it in that huge tank. And they're able to store so much more because once that gas turns into a liquid, it is 600 times more dense than before. All right, so now we are gonna get into the risks of natural gas over the next slides, but just keep in mind that processing LNG is dangerous. And I don't know how many of you heard about the Plymouth explosion here in Washington a couple years ago, but that's also an LNG storage facility there. And they had an explosion in some of the processing equipment, which sent shrapnel flying into one of the tanks and punctured it. And it also sent shrapnel, I think, up to like half a mile away and landed on railroad tracks. So that was just a small explosion there, but still had grave consequences, and five people were injured, in fact. And then, of course, natural gas is also dangerous. How many of you remember the explosion in the Seattle neighborhood that pretty much took out a city block? Right? So that's the same company that would be in charge of this one. And then how many of you also remember the Williams pipeline explosion that happened up in Canada late last year? And there's a lot of concern about knocking out the natural gas supply to Washington State, right? And they're saying, hey, if you use natural gas, turn down your thermostat because we're running out. So that exploded. So yeah, it's not a safe material. And according to Wikipedia, there are over 100 explosions per year, but you don't need to hear too much about them. All right, so one of PSE's stated reasons for the LNG project is to provide a cleaner shipping fuel for TOTE, right, as Bradley talked about already. And one of the reasons they say they have to provide this fuel is because the International Maritime Organization has said that ships can no longer emit, you know, certain pollutants into the air while they're operating. And that level has been coming down and down more and more about sulfur. And so they're saying that in order for TOTE to comply with these new strict regulations, they need to burn this LNG, liquefied natural gas. And in fact, liquefied natural gas does burn cleaner than heavy bunker fuel or diesel. But that's only if you measure it, you know, at the point of emission. But if you take into account the whole life cycle process, which we'll talk about a bit later, it's worse for the climate than potentially even coal. And so this is a bit misleading when they say that they must switch that. For a while, TOTE did get an exemption from complying with these regulations by saying that they were switching to LNG. But then since LNG plant has been behind schedule, and in fact they've delayed the conversion of their ships, they have now started burning what's called ultra-low sulfur diesel. And that allows them to comply with those regulations without us having to build a big plant here in our backyard and have emissions 24 hours a day. So like they've already switched to ultra low sulfur diesel. Other ships are tackling this problem by using what are known as scrubbers. So, you know, you have the big exhaust coming out at the top of the ship, and before all the exhaust escapes, they have what's called the scrubber, which helps capture some of the particulate matter and sulfur that would normally escape into the atmosphere. So that's another technology that can be used to continue using existing fuel sources. And so we can also talk about other solutions like designing the ships to be more fuel efficient, with better hull design. There are some technologies that they say you put a little stream of bubbles in front of the ship and that makes it go faster. But other companies like Maersk, for instance, they don't see LNG as a solution. And other companies, I believe like Wilhelmsen from Sweden, they believe that switching to slower ships, because right now these cargo ships can go 30 or 40 knots, but they believe they need to switch to slower ships that go maybe 10 to 15 knots, and they'll use rigid sail systems and most likely hydrogen to power their journeys. So yeah, I kind of talked about that already. So Bradley?
Yeah. So who are Puget Sound Energy? And so who thinks Puget Sound Energy is local, right? We think of Puget Sound Energy as being local. Where do you think Puget Sound Energy, where do you think their shareholders live, or where do you think their investors live? It's actually Canada. So it was Australia, and then they, again, those Australian shareholders sold out, and now it's mostly kind of pension fund investors from Canada, but also the Netherlands. Oops, sorry.
Just have to hold it up a little higher.
Here?
I'll
just put these down. I got it, but thank you. So earlier I mentioned the advertising, and so one of the ads you see a lot from Puget Sound Energy talks about how LNG is clean, safe, and local. So let's think about that as we go through this presentation, because we've already talked about safety, and we'll talk more about safety. We'll talk a lot about clean and whether or not natural gas, or I'd like to start calling it fracked gas, because that really is what gas is. And then last would be local. Well, are Puget Sound Energy local? No, actually they're not. They are based in Bellevue. That's where their main headquarters offices are. So they are what's called a private monopoly energy utility in Washington state. That differs from a public utility such as we have here in Tacoma or like Seattle has. So a public utility is owned by the municipality and its benefits accrue to the citizens, right, or the residents of that city. A public energy utility is really governed or regulated by the state very tightly. Because again, what we don't want is people being priced out of being able to afford energy. Puget Sound Energy, this is kind of the map of their areas. And so you'll find them in Western Washington where people don't have public utilities. So like I say, Tacoma, Seattle, Jefferson County became a public utility. But you'll find them in Thurston County, Bellingham. Other places, mostly for electricity, but then they sell predominantly, again, fracked gas. That's kind of what we buy. And many, many people heat their homes, myself included, with fracked gas, unfortunately, or use it for appliances, things like that. It's cheap. And that's a big component of fracked gas. That's kind of a lot of why we're in the trouble we're in, is because fracking made gas so cheap that literally they can't sell it. It's so cheap that they give it away, like in Texas. They pay people to take the gas because it's so cheap and prevalent. And killing our climate and our planet. But we'll get to that. So they have about 2 million customers. That's, like I say, electricity and gas. Interestingly enough, so here in Tacoma, what percent of our energy do you think is quote unquote clean or renewable? So by that I might mean hydroelectric, solar, wind. How much percent do you think in Tacoma is clean energy that we use? It's actually 97% of the electricity that we use in Tacoma comes from those sources, so hydro, solar, wind, predominantly hydro. Puget Sound Energy, yes? Yes, so 97% in Tacoma. In Seattle, it's comparable, but I forget. It might be actually higher than 98%. Puget Sound Energy, on the other hand, is close to 60% dirty. And by dirty, I mean coal, and I mean fracked gas. So again, you'll see advertising from Puget Sound Energy. If you look at any website or ad from Puget Sound Energy, you're going to see wind turbines because they do have a wind farm in eastern Washington. But again, remember, 60% of their energy actually is coming from dirty energy, predominantly coal, which is coming out of Montana. And then it makes some sense once you realize that the CEO of Puget Sound Energy actually is the former chair of the American Gas Association, or what I refer to as the American Fracked Gas Association, because that's really what it is. So again, it's a body of utilities and energy suppliers who advocate for more use of fracked gas, and that's exactly what Puget Sound Energy is pushing. And then last is, it's important to know that Puget Sound Energy is very powerful at Washington State. They have lots of money. They have lots of influence. They have more lobbyists in Olympia than almost any other actually company in Washington State. They've spent $7.2 million in that 10-year time frame to influence government. Here locally, you'll find them on neighborhood councils. You'll find them embedded kind of throughout kind of government and public agencies, sometimes because they're knowledgeable players, right, who are in the field, but sometimes we think it's also about influence at the local level, which again is a strategy actually, interestingly enough, pushed by the American Gas Association. There's a strategy handbook they have. And that includes embedding yourselves into local agencies. So how did we get here? So for a large project like this, you have to go through a SEPA process, which is a State Environmental Policy Act. And it looks at environmental impacts of large projects like this that would have impact on local environments. That's a very regulated process through Department of Ecology. And so what happened actually is Puget Sound Energy signed the lease with the Port of Tacoma in 2014, but then this SEPA process started to play out. Well, notification was within 40 or 440 feet of the, no, maybe it was 400 feet, 40? 400 feet of the tank. Well, you've seen the picture. There's not much around surrounding the tank within 400 feet. So literally nobody knew. And so the original meetings that they held, very few people showed up. When they did public, they invited the public to comment on the project. There's very few comments because nobody literally knew about the project until long story short, because of methanol, people have heard of the methanol project. Because of that, it raised attention, or we started to look really at the port, and that's really when people who are very astute locally and do a lot of research were able to find this project and started to look critically at this project as well. I think you're next. Yes?
All right. So yeah, one of the dangers of this project is of course, as I mentioned before, there are explosions, right? And if you talk to industry experts, they actually say that facilities like this should be located at least 3 miles away from where anybody lives, right? And as you can see here on this, I don't know how clear it is to you, but I mean, that's the site right there where the LNG facility is gonna be. And then the first blue ring here is the 1 mile exclusion zone. And the next is the two. And all those red dots are schools and daycares within that radius there. And so if something happens at that facility, that's going to spell danger for a lot of people. And what you can't see on this map as well is where the Northwest Detention Center is. And that's where 1,600 people are being held and essentially living down here in the port, turning that into a residential area. And they have no evacuation plans. Their plan is to shelter in place if anything happens at this facility. And also, yeah, so this has been an interesting issue here in Tacoma because if you can see this green line, this is the original line for the Puyallup Medicine Creek Treaty, delineating the Puyallup tribal territory. And this green line ended here because the land ended there back then, right? But all this, the rest of these peninsulas have been built out mostly on slag from ASARCO and other industrial waste. And so the LNG facility is being built on top of this infill, this toxic infill. And so this has been kind of an interesting issue in court, which you'll hear about a bit later, about whose land exactly this is. All right, and so Puget Sound Energy is building this, but guess what? We get to help pay for it. Isn't that nice? And a large part of why they made it probably into a peak shaving facility as well is that so that they could justify offloading a lot of the cost to us. And so what does that mean exactly? So the project is supposed to cost them $310 million. Ratepayers, so how many people here buy natural gas from Puget Sound Energy? Yeah, a lot of people. So all you will be paying for a portion of this project, right? So in total, you're going to be paying for $133 million of this project. And PSE pays no sales tax for this. They already worked with the Washington State Legislature so that they don't have to pay sales tax on any of the construction costs. But to go back to the $133 million, though, so that's for very little use of the project, right? So they sell it as a peak shaver. So that they can supply electricity during the coldest days in the winter. And by their own estimates in their initial papers, they said that that would be only a couple days every few years, right? And they estimate that the PSE ratepayers would be using about 7% of the facility within a given time period, right? And that is very much less than the 43% of the cost that you're going to be footing. So that doesn't seem very fair. And more public subsidization of the fossil fuel industry. PSE gets $4 million in tax breaks a year. The city of Tacoma needs to put a new fire station down there because for LNG regulations, they need to have a fire station nearby. And this one would be right across the street if the plans are as what I last heard, which wouldn't be a very useful place in case there's a disaster at the LNG facility. That place might be one of the first places to go. And this is all to create 16 permanent jobs. They keep touting how amazing this is to create all these jobs, and it's only 16. What also is listed on here is that the city of Tacoma also has to pay for road upgrades to get to the LNG tank for all the heavy tanker trucks that are going to be going back and forth on it. And so I believe we're splitting that with with Puget Sound Energy, but still, we're paying $2.5 million to improve the roads for their business. Oh, sorry, one more thing on cost, too. So if you are a PSE customer and you live in the city of Tacoma, if you kind of total up all these subsidies, we've estimated that you'd be paying about $170 to Puget Sound Energy so that they can build this plant. You'll just be giving that to them thanks to the connections they have in government, thanks to all this embedded work that they do.
So all of this territory is Puyallup territory. They've been here since time immemorial. This is their lands that we're on. That land was stolen. All of the tide flats was actually treaty reservation land that was promised to them in perpetuity. And so that was promised in the Medicine Creek Treaty of 1854. That wasn't given to them. That was a deal made between sovereign nations, the Puyallup sovereign nation and the federal government. And so that came with obligations on our behalf. And so the fact that they no longer quote unquote own some of the port, much of the port, that's a process through which that land was taken from them. And so there may have been payment later on, but again, let's be clear, that land was promised to them in perpetuity. That's part of what a reserve means. And so when we talk about the port, or we talk about the tide flats, we're talking about the lands that were promised to the Puyallup tribe when they made a deal to settle on that, on those lands. Part of what a treaty promises is that you have access to your usual and accustomed hunting, fishing, gathering grounds. Well, the Puyallup people had a saying, which is when the tide goes out, the table is set. They gathered their food and they fished on the Puyallup River, but also in the tide flats. As Dan pointed out, this project is built on what was once tide land. And so this would have been usual and accustomed gathering and fishing grounds. This is where this is part of why they're so offended by the project. It's on where they lived and fished and gathered food for thousands and thousands of years. And so the Puyallup tribe, directly across from the plant, as Dan talked about, with risks of accidents, potential explosions, right across the waterway is their marina. And so there's a marina with boats and recreation, and that's where Canoe Journey lands, is right across the waterway. So again, it's an affront to the Puyallup tribe. The tribe faces dwindling salmon and orca. We know that the water is polluted. We know that all of the port is polluted. Much of it is some of the most polluted land in the nation that was Superfund site. All of Commencement Bay was Superfund site. And so again, we would say that the project through emissions, we'll talk about air emissions, would also, that those air emissions come down into the water. And so we would say that the project itself has an impact on the water. And if it has impact on water, it has impact on salmon and orca. It's also a violation of treaty rights. So again, violating the right to gather on their usual and accustomed hunting and gathering grounds. And then again, the Puyallup people are really, I say, are the experts at living on this land. They lived here for thousands and thousands of years in a sustainable manner. They're the experts on how to live on this land. And this is how, this is really, again, this is, the project itself to me is an affront to that, for people who show us how to live sustainably with the land. Second is, you can't look at this project. You'll see advertising that talks about the point of combustion or the point of ignition and how clean, right? We're back to the idea of clean. That is cleaner. There's less emissions that come from that point of ignition with natural gas or fracked gas. What you're not talking about is the life cycle. You aren't looking at the whole project. You can't look at just the end of the project or where the gas is processed and stored without looking at where it's sourced or where it's coming from. And guess what we find in Northeast Canada or Northeast British Columbia, where the gas is sourced from, and they're saying they'll get 100% of their gas from Northeast British Columbia. Again, you're finding indigenous tribes. You're finding people whose land has been compromised and degraded as a result of fracking. There's an earthquake, so as big an earthquake as 4.5, which shut down all fracking in British Columbia, and that was directly attributed to fracking by scientists. You're talking about pipelines then that run through indigenous lands. You're talking about people who live near fracking sites or fracking wells. And I'm a registered nurse, so there's direct impacts on air, on maternal health, on respiratory health, as well as on groundwater, which is polluted as a result of the fracking. So you can't, if we're going to be stewards, if we're going to look at the environmental impacts of a project like this, we have to look at the whole life cycle, not just at what or at the impact at the Port of Tacoma.
Did I do that last?
Yeah. All right, so again, one of the other impacts is the climate change impact. And as I was talking about earlier, methane, which is a primary component of natural gas, is 86 times worse than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. And oftentimes these projects, like this LNG project, are considered over a 100-year time scale. And they like to say, oh, it's only 36 times as worse over 100 years. And they talk about that as if that's a positive, right? But if the thing that you're emitting is 36 times worse than the thing that you're replacing, as Tarika Powell says, like, that doesn't sound like a very good deal. So here we can see a lovely graph. Everybody loves graphs. About the impact of different fossil fuels for climate change. And here, the vertical axis is how many grams of CO2 equivalent, right? Because everything is measured based on CO2. So 1 ton of CO2 is the same, well, 1 ton of methane is the same as 86 tons of CO2, for example. But here we see that, well, we'll start with coal. It has a lot of CO2 emissions and very little methane emissions. And diesel oil, same thing. And then regular natural gas, natural gas light, I guess, has quite a bit of CO2 and then a lot of methane emissions. And then fracked gas from shale, which we talked about with breaking apart the rock underground, has a huge amount of methane emissions. So that means that shale gas, which is, again, most of the gas we get now, is the most greenhouse gas damaging or intensive form of energy available per unit of energy. So it's much worse. This isn't a bridge fuel. This is like the worst possible fossil fuel that we could have picked to continue using to avert the climate catastrophe that's coming. So as I said, yeah, 86 times worse. And we really need to look at projects over a 20-year period, because how many people are familiar with the International Panel on Climate Change, the latest report, that says we have 12 years left to have radical, like, society-changing transformations in order to avoid the climate crisis, right? So we can't be looking at a project and saying, oh, over 100 years, it's kind of the same as diesel, right? We need to be changing everything radically. So we need to be looking at things over a 20-year period. And when you look at the project over a 20-year period, it looks much worse than doing nothing at all. So, yeah, I guess I said that stuff already there. So, yeah, again, one of the big problems with fracking is that a lot of gas escapes, right? Gas can escape very easily, right? And so 3% leakage rate is about the number that it takes for gas, methane, natural gas or methane, to be worse for the climate than coal. And so here you can see that line, that methane leak threshold. Once the leakage rate passes that, then it's worse, right? And so here in the Denver Basin, where a lot of fracking occurs, they've measured a leakage rate of about 4%. So already there, it's worse, right? And that's not even counting the emissions downstream or in the distribution fields or, you know, in the pipelines or where it's actually burned. And if you think that's bad, this is very jumpy. In the Los Angeles Basin, they measured rates of 17% leakage. And you can see this all in Chasing Methane, which is an excellent news piece on YouTube.
So something I failed to mention is Dan and I and many other people are part of a group called 350 Tacoma. Well, what does 350 mean? 350 really was the safe upper limit of carbon in the atmosphere. So it's parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere that scientists deemed would keep a stable climate, if you will. And so it once was actually much, much lower than that, but 350 was kind of the upper limit of what they deemed safe or stable. And guess where we're at? We just surpassed 415 last week. So we're with a rocket on the rise still, even though people have tried to take action. And so I'm gonna present a couple sobering slides, because I feel like this news is not getting out the extent of how this is really an emergency situation. This isn't something for future generations. This is impacting us today. And so this slide shows, really, it's your carbon levels in the atmosphere, and it's measured over 800,000 years. And so if you go back, there is natural variability of carbon in the atmosphere. There's all sorts of reasons for that I won't get into. But there is natural variability. People will say, well, the climate changes all the time. Sure, it has, over the course of 800,000 years, not within our lifetimes. But look at the end. And so once you look at the 415 where we're at, this is within, really within the past 50 years, 50 to 100 years, you're seeing that spike. And like I say, we're on the rise still. This isn't an end. This is still rising every week or every month. What they saw last month actually was that carbon was rising more exponentially. I think it was the largest spike that they'd seen in many years. And so again, we aren't making progress. Let's be clear. There's a lot of talk and a lot of attention on it, but we aren't making progress on a global level. So then, like Dan said, there's kind of this number that's thrown around, which is 12 years. And what that means really, and this comes from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that Dan talked about that produced a report last year that was really, international best consensus on climate science. And it's not a report, it's a summary of research and reports from all over the globe and all over the world from the leading climate scientists in the world. And they did two things. They established that the goal needs to be 1.5 degrees of warming. That's 1.5 degrees of centigrade warming. That if we exceed that, we're looking at millions of people dying. And so there's people displaced. You're looking at potentially tipping points that take place between 1.5 and 2. So tipping points at which things become irreversible. We've never lived in a climate. Humanity has never lived in a climate with 415 carbon in the atmosphere. So in some ways, we're on this experiment. I liked an article that said this. We're all living in an experiment produced by Exxon, you know, in the oil industry, and we're living through that experiment. We don't really know how this plays out, to be honest. And so what this slide shows is really what's called a carbon mitigation budget. And so what you've got is they've determined, well, how much more carbon could we spew into the atmosphere or pollute the atmosphere with until really we've tipped past the point to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade. So you'll see at the top is where we're at. And so this is where the line becomes vertical, is the point at which it's impossible to not exceed 1.5 degrees warming. And so that's your 12 years. We're now down to 11 years. And so the goal is twofold, which is we have to reduce our carbon output by 50% in 10 years, 10 to 11 years, and we have to eliminate it or go actually negative by 2050. So imagine everything that's powered by fossil fuels at the moment or carbon-based fuel at the moment. Imagine reducing that by half globally in 10 years. Pretty sobering. So anyway, we always want to end on hope, and so we're going to get there in a minute. But I do want people to realize what we're up against, because when I look at this and people say, well, fracked gas or natural gas is a bridge fuel, we're going to get to that place where we have clean energy, but we aren't there yet. What I say is kind of like the stages of grief. You're in that bargaining phase where you're not really looking at the science. You're dealing with what you hope the science might be, but meanwhile, the science is here kind of staring you in the face. And so we can't change the problem without accepting the science or accepting the facts, and these are the facts. There's your hope.
So yeah, this is a great action. That was last September, was it, Carol?
8th September.
Yeah, and so this is a rise up action, and it took place all around the world. It was coordinated by 350.org. And this was action that happened here in Tacoma. And here we are crossing the 11th Street Bridge, led by Puyallup tribal members, as it should be. And so, yeah, the Puyallup tribe has been resisting this from the beginning. Bradley was mentioning those first public hearings where nobody showed up because they only notified people within 400 feet. I think there were 7 letters submitted to the city about this project. 6 of them said, oh, wow, what a wonderful project. We'd be happy to have LNG as our neighbor, and they're all pretty much the same. And then one was from the Puyallup tribe saying, wait a second, we don't want this here. And so they have been opposing it from the beginning. And so, yeah, they have been filing appeals and trying to stop the construction. The facility doesn't actually have all the permits it needs to continue, but they keep building it. So for right now, for example, they're trying to get the emissions permit so that they can pollute the air for the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. And they issued a stop work order, but Puget Sound Energy keeps building anyway. I think the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency would have to do more steps to actually step it up. But the Puyallup Tribe has been asking for construction to be halted for a long time now. But yeah, there are so many people involved with this. You know, we have 350 Seattle comes down here and helps on this. There are many actually experts in the room here from like Redefine as well that work on this, opposing this project. And so there, yeah, it's been really amazing to see the coalition of groups that have come together to oppose this. And at times it feels like we're not having any effect at all. I mean, we've been working on this for a couple years and it just seems like you're just going nowhere and just talking to a brick wall. I mean, that's still talking to city council, it's talking to a brick wall. But then we see that things actually change, things move, right? The Puget Sound Clean Air Agency required that this supplemental environmental impact statement be done that looks at the entire life cycle analysis of the natural gas that's gonna be used in this facility. So that alone was a victory. They were supposed to have already kind of released their findings from what I understand by now, but they had so many comments that they're still processing that, and we still don't know the timeline for when they're gonna come out about their decision on whether or not the permit is granted. And then, of course, yeah, you'll hear about some other people joining against this facility soon. And so, yeah, 14 affiliated tribes here in the Northwest have all signed on against this project. So, yeah, the indigenous communities do not want to hear. Seattle City Council passed a resolution against this facility, which I don't think Tacoma City Council particularly liked. Many legislative districts did as well, and you might be able to tell me better than I can about the Democratic parties here in Washington State actually passing resolutions against LNG. There's also the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. So healthcare providers like Bradley know that this facility is not good for anybody. Instead of having these two ships that come in and plug into shore power, they're the cleanest ships in the port. We're gonna have those ships come in and do that anyway. And we're gonna have a facility emitting 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. That doesn't seem like an improvement. And really interestingly, the Tacoma Human Rights Commission, which is a new commission, I believe the mayor started, wrote a letter saying, you guys really need to review this project. You guys need to do a supplemental environmental impact statement on the safety of this project, which still has not been done. And Tarika Powell has a lot of good information about all the safety failings of this project. And are you covering this part?
I can.
All right.
And I'll move through these pretty quickly. So there's been, when you're up against power, there's often limited things you can do to impact power, power influence, regulatory agency. And so civil disobedience sometimes is one of those tools that people can use to stand up to power. It's one of the historic strategies we've used. And so there has been a history of civil disobedience against the project. On the left, you'll see they were known as the Tacoma Six. And so what they did is six people locked down to this, they were drilling kind of these platforms, if you will. And so they locked down to the platforms and then were arrested and subsequently went to court. And then on the right, you'll see one of them is Steve Way from 350 Tacoma, and the other person is Carlo Voli from 350 Seattle. They entered the site during the morning, and then they scaled this crane and actually again locked down to the crane, and they stopped work for the day and were obviously subsequently arrested. The interesting part is that they both took it to court and they both asked for a jury trial. So not everybody went to court, but the ones who did go to court, So they actually both were found not guilty. And they were found not guilty, guess why? Because the jury didn't believe that the location where the tank or the project was located was Port of Tacoma property. And so experts from the Puyallup tribe came and testified that these were their usual and accustomed hunting gathering grounds, that this was fill, this wasn't original land, and that really that's treaty territory. And they said that they had invited all of these people onto their land, and the jury found them innocent. So, pretty awesome. So, like Dan said, Puget Sound Energy continues to build. We think that's part of the strategy, is they try to show that they're unstoppable. And so they continue to build, even though even the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency has said they build at their own risk. They may not get the permits needed to operate the plant. They're taking that risk by continuing to build. And so people said, well, if they can build without permits, so can we. And so indigenous leaders took a longhouse to Puget Sound Energy and erected it outside of their front doors and essentially stopped work that day at Puget Sound Energy, making the point that this is what it looks like to have unpermitted construction. And so if Puget Sound Energy can do it, why can't we?
Yeah, this now is back.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, and what can we do about this right now? So one of our best chances right now is to call Governor Inslee and ask him to please stop construction of this project, because I don't know if many of you know, but he came out and said that I can no longer in good conscience support the continued construction of the LNG facility in Tacoma. That was amazing. We had been working on that for, again, years. And finally, he's admitted that, you know, the science has convinced him. The science says that we simply cannot use natural gas as a, quote-unquote, bridge fuel. And so these projects cannot exist if we want a livable future on the planet. There are also, lots of petitions you can sign on board. The Stand With the Puyallup petition that Redefine has started. I believe that's up to 60,000?
65,000.
65,000 signatures. Of people, standing against this project. And then also, even though they have been reluctant to do anything or even answer anything about it, we still want to keep applying pressure to the City Council of Tacoma, because still, the City of Tacoma is the lead agency for the environmental review of this project. And as long as they have not said they won't or they will do another review, we can't go any further. We need a firm answer from them either way. And then with that answer, then we can appeal to the Department of Ecology. So yeah, there's the quote from Jay Inslee. Learn more about the Puyallup tribe and the treaties, like the Medicine Creek Treaty. There's a great documentary called Ancestral Waters, made by Native Daily Network. And there'll be screenings in town. You can probably find it online. We hope to have a screening at some point at our new space down on Puyallup Avenue. You can come organize with us. Come join 350 Tacoma. Or, you know, Indivisible, of course, does lots of great stuff, and you can help push it through Indivisible. There's a great psc-lng.com website that is actually a spoof of the Puget Sound Energy website. And so instead of saying all this greenwashing stuff, it actually tells the truth. And so that's kind of a fun read. Another thing you can do is divest your money from fossil fuels. So a lot of the banks that we use actually fund these projects. So I don't know if many of you know, but Wells Fargo is one of the main contributors of this project, as is Chase Bank, I believe. So if we can take all our money out of those banks, we can send the message that we don't want our money being used to fund these kinds of projects. And let us know if we can come give this presentation to other groups. It's nice to reach out to groups rather than just individuals. And when the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency comes back with their decision, we'll be calling on people in the community to help come give feedback to them to hopefully try and deny that permit completely.
I feel like maybe we should do questions before the video.
All right.
So after this.
Okay. Try to do this? Okay. So, growing opposition. So the Puyallup tribe, you know, they've always been there from the beginning, but they have pointed out 7 clear changes that have happened to the project since it was first proposed, right? When it was first proposed, the city had it reviewed by supposedly an impartial company, but then since then, it's changed in 7 major ways. And so the Puyallup tribe is saying that it needs to be reviewed again. Again, Governor Inslee has come out against it. The Tacoma Human Rights Commission has said, hey, you need to do a safety review of this project because there are serious concerns. And the Attorney General's office, they actually submitted a letter to the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency during the comment period, and in that letter it said that parts of that environmental impact statement were fictional. So that was very powerful. And State Ecology also wrote in and gave a comment as well. And they said that your review should really use the best available science. Because unfortunately, in that review that was produced, they used scientific data from 2007 that said that methane was only, what number were they using, like 25 times as bad over a 100-year period, when in fact it's 30 times as bad as carbon dioxide over a 100-year period. And it went from, I don't know, went up to 86. But anyway, it's much worse. So if they'd actually been using the most of a recent best available science to do this review, the project would be seen to be worse for the climate than doing nothing at all. All right, so does anybody have any questions?
And that probably isn't in the Americas. It definitely isn't maybe in North America with Canada or the United States. So where would you go to get a pretty good price for it?
So what I see is we have cheap, abundant fracked gas. It's all over. I mean, it's in BC, it's in Texas, it's all over the Midwest, in the Colorado Basin. And so what I see, and this is a pattern I think we see here locally very clearly, is that people are looking to monetize, right, fracked gas. So it's so cheap, abundant, you're trying to add money to that thing, right? And so methanol is a great example of where you refine it or turn it into this other product that then China wanted. And so we could monetize it, ship it, export it to China, and they'd pay a premium for it. And so that same thing. It's like if you can figure out how that's, look at the abundance of plastics in our environment. That's directly attributed to cheap fracked gas. We're basically throwing away plastics. It's so cheap. It's only cheap because of fracked gas. And so your point is well taken, which is, I don't know the markets at which they pay the premium, but once you turn it into liquefied natural gas, you've already monetized that product, right? And now you're shipping it somewhere. Absolutely.
So then the question becomes, okay, so does Seattle want an LNG port? Los Angeles, does San Francisco?
Right.
Absolutely not.
Right.
Absolutely not. So what they really need is a place with, let us say, malleable and honest politicians. By honest, I mean ones who will stay bought. and they found it, and it's here. So we can quibble about Toad pushing up to Anchorage and back and peak shaving. I think what they're really going for is to turn us into the West Coast port for LNG.
And
so they can ship it across the ocean.
They're looking for a port on the West Coast to do that. And so they've tried Coos Bay, Oregon, which is where I actually ironically grew up. And so they've tried to push actually a massive export, LNG export project there. It looks like it's going down into defeat for the third year or third time. And those people in Coos Bay have fought this project for now approaching 14 years. So each time it's defeated, it comes back. It's like a zombie that keeps coming back to life. They're also looking at Anchorage. And so from the North Slope, they would put more pipeline in and there would be an LNG export from Anchorage. They're looking for a port, just like currently really most of the frac gas that's exported comes from. It would come through the Panama Canal, which is why the Panama Canal was actually widened, was to accommodate LNG tankers. So they're looking for, yes, you're going to have a lot less distance, so it's going to be cheaper to get your product to market from the West Coast. But Sightline Institute has called the Pacific Northwest really the thin green line, and we call it that because so far we've been able to defeat almost any fossil fuel project that's been pitched on the West Coast in the Pacific Northwest. And we want to keep that statistic. We don't want Tacoma to be the only place that winds up with an export facility. So yeah, point well taken.
Well, yep. The irony is that the industry brought both methanol and LNG here.
Yeah.
And methanol we deflected down to Kalama. We wouldn't have sent it to Kalama, but that's where it was deflected.
So it was actually proposed in three places. We were one of three. We were the biggest here. It actually doubled. But the three projects were the same. And it was here, Kalama, and then across the Columbia River in Oregon. But we pushed the ours back, and so two still survive, the one in Kalama, and there's one across the Columbia. Good question.
Well, we as 350 Tacoma cannot endorse nor condemn, I guess, any candidate being a 501c3.
We can condemn.
But yeah, I believe there is a Combs who is running for blocker's position. He has actually taken the fossil-free pledge, so he will not take any money from any fossil fuel companies. And so that would be amazing. Other than that, honestly, I don't really know of anybody else that would oppose it. And it.
Courtney Love is running against McCarthy, and she's come out against it too.
So yeah, even if we get two people that are against it or mild environmentalists, we're kind of back to square one because right now we're losing Ryan Mello and Anders Ibsen, and they were two of the people who were most likely to question anything about the LNG plant or keep in mind the environment when making decisions about the city, and so.
Anyway, it's not enough to question. It's not enough to come out with a statement. We need action.
Of course.
Ensley was the guy who brought it here. He's so, governor. He can stop it.
So the other.
He's not gonna.
So.
We need to have other people ask questions.
I'm going to pass around a 350 Tacoma email sign-up list while Bradley is answering the questions. So if you're interested in getting more updates from us, we don't inundate your inbox. Please sign up on this sheet.
So the lead agency is City of Tacoma. And so state ecology can kind of designate someone to be a lead agency for the regulatory process. And it's been City of Tacoma from the beginning. Which is there are some problems with that in that people from the city, especially city council, had actually written letters in support of the project. And so you both have a regulatory agency that's overseeing the process, but then you also have a city and the city council and the mayor who actually was cheerleading behind the scenes and leading the process. So we think that's a conflict of interest. Second question was about... Oh, so fracked gas has been a story of Democrats, believe it or not. And, some of that I think is forgiven because the science wasn't as clear and alarming as it is today. But there are still many Democrats who have not changed their position. And so one of them actually is Democrat Jake Fey. And again, I'm not kind of endorsing anything, but I am saying he was one of several legislators who led the efforts to get specific tax incentives for Puget Sound Energy that quite honestly brought the project to our port. Without those incentives, the project would not have been economically beneficial to Puget Sound Energy. Any questions? Steve.
Not really a question, but you were talking about the last 800,000 years since human. I mean, the new quote is that this the CO2 equivalent is higher than at 419 or whatever it is today. It's higher than it has been in the last 3 million years.
That's correct.
Sea level was 65 feet higher, and that's where we're headed, but it takes a while to get there. And I think they said Greenland was green and there was trees in the Antarctic.
And that's
where we're looking at if we just kept where we are right now.
That is where we're headed.
And the other question, you showed what happened when the civil disobedient people got arrested and released. The most important thing that I thought was after one of the trials, some of the jurists came out and wanted to join our group.
Right.
I mean, that was the most important thing I'd seen. I mean, that was great.
Thank you.
We can also show